Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Charity Charge Show. Today, I'm excited and honored to interview Aaron Moat, who is the Executive Director of Innovate EDU. Aaron, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks. I'm so excited to be here.
Absolutely. I will just get started. I wanted to read quickly for the audience the overview and mission statement for Innovate EDU. Right. Innovate EDU is a nonprofit whose mission is to eliminate the achievement gap by accelerating innovation in Common Core aligned next generation learning models and tools that serve, inform, and enhance teaching and learning. Innovate EDU is committed to massively disrupting K-12 public education by focusing on the development of scalable tools and practices that leverage innovation, technology, and new human capital systems to improve education for all students and close the achievement gap. That's inspiring.
Thanks. Well, I have a great team that's helping us really work towards that mission and accomplish those goals, as well as a slew of national partners. So it's not just us alone. There's a lot of people who are committed to radical disruption to serve
our kids. Personally speak and attest to that, because you had me over as a guest at your South by Southwest party.
Yes.
A lot of great people there just recently. Hey. Thank you for that.
Yeah, of course. Of course. I hope you met some fun, interesting new allies.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, it was really inspiring. I can go on that, and maybe I'll touch on it a little bit later on, but I want you to, you know, I obviously read your kind of mission statement and an overview of Innovate EDU. Tell us what you guys are up to. Why are you passionate about it? This is clearly something that I feel like you've had an interesting and really like awesome career so far, but this seems to really speak to you. And so why is that?
Yeah, I mean, Innovate EDU is the place for me where passion has met profession. And I think if you can find that in your life, you're incredibly lucky. And if you can find people who join that journey with you, you're even luckier. And so I'm really excited about not only what we've done over the last 8 years at Innovate EDU, but frankly, the road ahead. And folks always ask me, you know, why do you want to take on such big, hairy, audacious challenges and problems? And the answer is because I think we are at the most urgent moment in our country's history when it comes to education and our kids. And right now, I think the last couple of years have shown, maybe you're like me and you're a working mom who had to do kindergarten on Zoom with their child for the last year, and our teachers are working incredibly hard. Our system is working incredibly hard. And yet we are still leaving so many young people behind. And your opportunity is often the function of the zip code that you live in. And frankly, you know, there are a lot of lost Einsteins out there. Young people who are frankly geniuses, and they live in the wrong zip code. They go to the wrong school. They don't have the types of opportunities that other children have in our country. And my job is to make sure that young people have access to education, regardless of the zip code that they were born into.
And how did you get inspired specifically to found this organization?
Thanks. That's a really great question. So I used to almost only work exclusively in a global context. So I worked with folks that your listeners know, like the State Department and USAID and others, almost entirely outside of the US. In fact, there were years I didn't have to pay income taxes because I was more than 320 days outside of the country doing work, which, you know, no longer applies, but it was a nice moment when that happened. The work that we were doing overseas, whether we were in Dadaab, the largest refugee camp in the world, or South Sudan when it became a country, or when we were in Jordan in the middle of the largest migration of refugees in the Middle East in modern times, what I realized is that technology had the incredible opportunity to help connect people and to bridge gaps and to give access to opportunity that we couldn't even imagine 10 or 20 years ago, whether that was a young person being able to do a Cisco Networking Academy in South Sudan as they were just connected to the internet, or it was a refugee worker in Dadaab who was able to do work, remote work for a large major international tech company, doing data entry or call center work. Technology has this incredible power to connect people. I often talk about the currency of connectivity and what happens when you connect folks. And then I was back in the States, and I was actually doing a fellowship at the Aspen Institute and had done a ton of work on something called universal service funds overseas, which is the taxes that you're charged on your mobile phone. Right now, you'll see a little charge that says universal service fund charge. Every country in the world who uses mobile
telephone. Gonna find out. This is why we met.
To know what those are for, right? For
20 years what this is.
Please, yeah, but no. Universal service funds are the dollars to use from folks who are paying their bill to extend connectivity where it is so expensive to connect that it needs an incredible amount of subsidy. So think about as the tax that you're paying in order to connect rural areas of this country and, you know, making sure you have service in Yellowstone National Park when you go hiking or places where connectivity is just harder because of topography or population or something like that. And so at that moment, the U.S. Department of Education and the FCC and the White House during the Obama administration were making a big push towards E-rate modernization, which is the dollars that we use to connect schools and connect computer labs in schools and provide Wi-Fi for schools. And what was happening is that they wanted to use universal service funds as a way to extend connectivity for E-rate. And actually, countries around the world have been doing this for 20 years. It's why Kenya went from, you know, leapfrogged the United States when it came to mobile telephony, mobile banking, mobile health, is because they used universal service funds in order to connect that country. And so I ended up kind of getting bitten by education. I got bitten by the bug because I went from my house in Columbia Heights, where I was living in DC, and I took a subway stop, 5-6 subway stops out to Anacostia. And I literally walked schools with folks. And it turned out that those schools were using dial-up internet in 2011. And that's how their kids had access to the internet or access to filling out their job applications. They were literally, a computer cart was getting pushed around the school. And so it hooked me. I had sort of the lens revealed that the work that I could have been doing globally, I could do actually in my own community in the United States, and then eventually in my own community in Brooklyn, New York, where I founded a school and founded Innovate EDU with this idea that we can take on these big challenges by bringing together uncommon alliances of people, technology, and tools in order to meet these challenges.
That's awesome. Wow. So talk to us about some of the practical things like you've been proud of, you know, over the years, and also, you know, just browsing around on your organization's website, for example, you have a variety of different projects, educating all, I mean, I could go through the list, but Pathways Alliance, Educating All Learners, Project Unicorn. And I know Cortex was something that you're really proud of. So talk to us through some of the highlights of what you've been able to accomplish and get started.
Yeah, well, I think about our projects in kind of three different areas. The first is field-based programs, and that's our LabCorp fellowship and work that we're doing to have a lighthouse program around after school in the heart of New York City. So bringing the best of out of school time into the school day. So coding opportunities for young people, the ability to do work that really drives discovery and self-identity that doesn't necessarily maybe happen in a math class, but does happen when you take, you know, math and apply it to the angles in basketball in order to improve your jump shot. The work that we're doing in the fellows, where we have over 8 years trained over 200 educators to become teachers, 99% of which identify as educators of color, who have gone into New York City and have gone nationally to become teachers, leaders, operations managers, principals now. Some of them didn't stay in education. They went on to become doctors and other things. That real investment in human capital. So keeping really close to the field and being anchored in the work is a big part of Innovate EDU. The second part of our work, like Project Unicorn, Educating All Learners Alliance, Pathways Alliance, is about bringing together uncommon alliances of people and organizations to take on those large challenges. Oftentimes, these are organizations that haven't worked together before. They're meeting each other for the first time. They're learning about each other. You know, this is my play to address what I like to call cooperation in our sector, where we have nonprofits who are, you know, trying to cooperate, but they're really competing for scarce philanthropic dollars. And so it really minimizes the impact of what one organization could do. What if we all came together around a shared agenda?
Let's go down this path actually. And I'd love it, you know, to the extent, whatever you're comfortable sharing, both the, you know, kind of the pros and the cons, or the positives and some of the negatives things that have come from it. There's been a few other people that I've interviewed on the podcast that have sort of coined this as the nonprofit industrial complex. And, you know, even in conversations, you know, with a lot of folks that I know that run fairly large foundations, you know, they've talked about how they've even gone out to their grantees and said, hey, we'll give you more money if you guys, if you all work together. And like, here's a project that we, you know, or, you know, a pot of money we think addresses like what you all have, you know, put in, you know, individually. And those organizations actually came back to that foundation head. And I mean, I couldn't name it, I wouldn't matter, but whatever. They give out about $100 million a year. So pretty significant amount. And the nonprofit said, no, we don't want the extra money. We just want our own. Like, we're not going to work together. So what's going on there? And then what have you been able to kind of innovate on?
Yeah, so, you know, whenever we do a new alliance, I always introduce this concept that's part of our manifesto if you go on our website, and I call it the 80% common. Can we bring organizations together under the principle that we're not going to agree on 100% of stuff? We're not going to agree on 100% of programs, 100% of the decisions made, 100% of the things that we want to do together, or maybe one organization wants to do, the other doesn't. But is there 80%? Can we get to 80%? Can we get to 70%? This is actually a technology principle, right? Like, where you have a stack of technology that is similar on the back end, but on the front end has a customizable view. So I always use Uber and Lyft, you know, two behemoths in the transportation industry. They actually run almost the identical tech stack on the back end, Google Maps, Braintree for payments, other pieces like that. But what is different is they have differentiated themselves in terms of the user experience, right? Their, and also their branding, right? Lyft goes with a more pink brand. It's more fun. It has had a reputation of being more community-based. Uber, more corporate, more professional, directly targeting businesses as a core client, trying to set up that as a stream of business. And so, you know, they're rivals in the same space, but their back end is actually the same. And when I talk to organizations, I try to help them understand that a lot of us have a similar back end, and the front end experiences of our constituents are probably a little bit different, but we can find that 80% common. And that means people have the ability to opt in and opt out, right? There are clear rules of the road that, you know, for example, Educating All Learners Alliance, we never weigh in on federal policy. We just don't do it. We don't weigh in on federal or state or local policy. It could cause divisions within our members. It's the 20% that isn't common. And so the alliance has clear rules around how we operate and what we do and how that works. But we also deliberately are trying to build connective tissue between the organizations, bringing people together in working groups, having them see each other as common allies, creating, honestly, just like social opportunities for people to meet the person behind the organization, I think is really, really important. And I actually hope foundations do support more of this type of connective tissue in our space and in this work. I believe that that's the way we increase diversity, equity, and inclusion, and the voices that are at the table, the folks who are participating in decision-making. If we have those types of organizations, institutions, alliances that are focused on connective tissue and alliance building. And frankly, you know, I think that's a new model in education in some ways. You have to be able to drive and bring more value to a partner organization when they're in an alliance. You have to be directing more traffic to their website, putting them more out front, giving them speaking opportunities, participating in panels, highlighting their work, using your platform to do the work, and in some cases, bringing them additional financial capital. But I talk a lot about how social capital, I don't believe, is a finite resource. I actually believe you can build your social capital the more you give it away. And so as a leader at Innovate EDU, personally, I try to do that all the time with young entrepreneurs and folks that I'm meeting who are entering the space or who are established players in the space. But I also really try to push organizations to do that too. Because when we build a bigger network, we can have the network effect, and we need that network effect to solve large challenges and collective action, which are a lot of the BHAGs that Innovate EDU is working on.
That's awesome. Really appreciate you sharing that. Yeah. And it's inspiring too, because I think that, you know, as I was alluding to in my past experience, a lot of organizations have really struggled with this whole concept of partnering and trying to, you know, kind of do more with other organizations. So it's great that you point that out. Can you talk to us, like, give us a perspective? I know that, you know, to the extent you want to share, knowing that a lot of financials and certain things about organizations are just kind of public knowledge, but
yeah,
where are you guys at from a financial perspective? And then I want to talk to you about kind of how you've worked to scale the organization over time. And maybe a sense of, like, you know, how big your employee, you know, how many employees are with the organization. We have a lot of people that listen that are either thinking of starting a nonprofit or have an organization, but maybe they've only been at it for a couple of years and they're still like at 100,000 in revenue or 200,000 in revenue. And they're trying to figure out, how do I do more, grow more?
Yeah. Well, I will say I'm the founder of Innovate EDU. So for all of you out there that are founders and are in the struggle, let me just first say, like, stick with it. Stick with that place where passion meets profession with you, and you will get there. And there's lots of people, including me, who are here to help and help you on that journey. And I always try to create space for folks to reach out to me on LinkedIn or whatever. Just reach out, because there's a group of us who are willing and want to build more capacity in this space. We right now are about $5 million in annual revenue for Innovate EDU, getting over that hump, frankly, from 1 million and into the 3 million mark was the first hump, and then the mark from 3 million to 5 million. So now we're doing a lot of work where we're managing large multi-million dollar multi-year philanthropic grants. And that means we're, you know, sort of the fiduciary to other organizations, providing sub-grants to align the work, doing those pieces of the work. And we have a pretty diverse revenue base. So we have fee-for-service programs. We have some government contracts, obviously, with our after-school program. We have traditional philanthropic grants from major foundations. And then we actually license our software as well. And so we have a pretty diverse revenue base. In terms of employee size, because of our field-based programs, we swell to about 70 employees during the school year. And then when school's not in session and our school-based programs aren't running, we go back to about 25 full-time core staff who are managing the other sets of programs at Innovate EDU. We're pretty lean, honestly, for organizations that are similarly situated in our size. And that's a deliberate decision. We believe that, you know, culture of thrift is actually in our core founding values, because we want to get as much money from philanthropic organizations and these revenue sources directly into the field and in and with partners who are working every day with young people, with teachers, with parents, with superintendents, so on and so forth. We also believe it's really important to create expertise. And so oftentimes one of the things that we'll do is stipend folks to be able to participate in conversations, so that it's not always the CEO of an organization that we're inviting to the table. It might be somebody who's more junior or somebody who hasn't yet had that opportunity to share their voice. This particularly impacts women and people of color. And one of the things that we do is we stipend folks to participate in some of our projects where we're building large-scale infrastructure, because they can only get permission to participate because they're bringing revenue into the organization. And so I think a lot of what we think about is like, how do we expand the social license to operate that we have around this alliance building work? I will say one thing that's coming for us, excuse me, which I'm really excited about, is the opportunity to spin our product portfolio. So Cortex, Landing Zone, some of the other products we're working on, into a for-profit on July 1. And one of the reasons we're doing that is because these products have gained scale and product market fit. And right now they really can't be developed or scaled more at a not-for-profit. One, because it would tip our earned income revenue and the IRS would come find me, but also because in order to scale these products, we need to be hiring and doing investment in R&D and development ahead of revenue coming in. And so we're at a place where we're about to do something that I think not a lot of people do, which is spin a for-profit off of a nonprofit. We've worked for 2 years to do this. It's going to be called Converge. And I'm incredibly excited about that because I know, excuse me, it's going to allow access to more of our products with more folks around the country. So stay tuned for that. I'll have some, I'm sure, great lessons learned and adventures coming from that spinoff where we're hiring a new CEO. It'll be an autonomous organization. Lots of fun stuff happening there.
That is pretty amazing. How does that, just curious if you could share now, how does it work when a nonprofit spins off a for-profit? Who can become the owners of the for-profit?
Yeah, so it's, how does it work? You will spend a lot of your life with lawyers. That is how it works, is there's really smart lawyers who are helping us do this. And frankly, I assembled a kitchen cabinet of friends and family, advisors, investors, who for the last 2.5 years have helped us make this transition, given us really good advice, helped us structure that. Basically, like, we become the nonprofit, Innovate EDU becomes the majority shareholder of the for-profit company and must stay and remain in controlling shares of the organization. And then the way we're structuring this is we're expanding our board. We just added 2 new board members this last week at Innovate EDU. And then ultimately there will be 4 board members who are shared between Innovate EDU and Converge. So they'll have both board seats. And then I'll be serving at least for the first 3 years as chairwoman of the board during this transition. So a big part of that is because I wanna make sure that Converge maintains that mission, vision, values orientation that is the lifeblood of Innovate EDU and the lifeblood of our technology product development.
That is really cool that you're doing. Let me ask you here, going back to the beginning of Innovate EDU, how did you raise the first money for the organization? You know, I interact with, especially because, you know, we do lines of credit for nonprofits and all that. Like, a lot of them come to us first and they're like, oh, we want to get a credit card so we can like put our initial expenses on it. I'm like, wait, try not to go into debt when you're starting an organization, but it's always like a chicken and the egg. So How did you get started, like get your initial kind of funding and just kind of get off the ground?
Yeah. So first I will say that, you know, we, both my husband and I, who is, my husband, Eric, is a huge partner in our work. And we founded a network of charter schools at the same time we founded Innovate EDU. And he still is deeply involved in our charter schools, Brooklyn Lab charter schools. But honestly, to do that work with Brooklyn Lab and to do the work with Innovate EDU, I had to side hustle. Like, I was doing consulting and it was my own personal capital that went in for the first couple of times. And I used, you know, a chunk of savings in order to be able to do that, to live in New York City and have enough time to build an organization and actually pay an employee at startup, and who's still with me today. She's our chief of staff. And, you know, Kate Cochran is as much a founder of Innovate EDU as I am. But I had to dip into my own personal savings. And then we got our first grant from Next Generation Learning Challenges, for the schools. And that helped us really develop the Brooklyn Lab model, but it also helped us think about, okay, we got a really great set of advice from some early folks who we actually thought Brooklyn Lab would house a lot of the things that Innovate EDU was doing. But at founding, we got some really great advice in a windowless hotel room in San Francisco with a dolphin tank of folks who had a lot of experience in the schools and innovation space in education. And they told us to explicitly split them, to split the innovation arm from the schools arm, and not to, to be really intentional about what each was doing and to separate leadership and a number of other things. And so we did that. But we got our first set of grants from folks like the Michael and Susan Dell Foundation.
And in my backyard.
Right in your backyard. And Michael Dell and the foundation have been huge supporters of Innovate EDU and the work. I think that, you know, I'll just say that I think Michael Dell and Janet Mountain, who's the leader of the foundation, uniquely understand the struggle of entrepreneurship, even entrepreneurs in a not-for-profit world, and uniquely understand the struggle of founders. And I really found a long-term partner, supporter, and advocate in the foundation with folks like Michael Dell, Susan Dell, Janet Mountain, Jamie O'Toole, just a slew of folks who in those early days were instrumental to our success. And then frankly, like, winners win, right? Like, this is the thing I think nobody talks about, which is once you start and clear money and show that you can manage it responsibly, the next set of money gets easier to raise. And then I think you hit those sort of humps, right? I call them like the mezzanine capital hump, or the one going from 1 to 3 million, that's a big hump. Going from 3 to 5, that's a big hump. It's not unlike the, you know, angel series A, B, C thing that exists in our for-profit counterparts space.
Really well said. I really appreciate you sharing that. And, you know, you have those war stories and I can, you know, relate with you. We've been at it. This June will mark 6 years with Charity Charge. And then before it, you know, I had the idea for a while. I was just trying to figure out how do we, you know, create a credit card company that would actually do good in the world. And so, a lot of things, a lot of interesting, you know, stories to tell, you know, on my own of that process, but
I'm sure I should interview you maybe.
Yeah. Right. Hey,
yeah, you
know, we'll go there on a different time, but, but I think that, I definitely am with you. I mean, one of the things someone said to me that I always called bullshit on and I was right about, I mean, but everyone's experience is different. They sort of said to me when I started, like, good luck, it only gets harder from here. And I'm like, it should only get easier. And it's actually only gotten easier. I mean, once we started getting traction and growth and revenue and customers and like all that stuff, you know, I've just hired really great people. And
that's a big part of it.
Honestly,
right?
Like, people say that, but that's just like the truth. Like, this thing does not hum without individuals. And obviously, like, we've tried to be very innovative with our processes to have as much like software and things behind the scenes and, you know, all those things that you would want to have for automation purposes. But at the end of the day, like, you do need humans to run organizations, and you need great ones. And it's just like, not, it's so important to have great people because it changes everything.
Yeah.
And not just for like the smoothness of like their actual capability to get the job done, but the no BS factor that you get. That's the best. It's like, you know, I just want passionate, hardworking people that can act like adults to like get their job done, you know, and be good, kind people and all that. And it's a tall order, like, but
yeah,
you got to put in the effort to attract them and all of that. I'm excited. We're about to have someone new join the team next month, and I feel really good about them. And it's, you know, I going through the process now where we've had the wrong people also, like, you kind of learn what to look out for.
I think that people really matter, right? Like, I think, you know, we look at balance sheets and think that's where we talk about assets and deficits. That's where we talk about the things, but actually we need to turn around and look at the table that we're sitting at. And that's where there are probably our most valuable assets. And that's our people. I do want to say, though, that I think there are moments in this fundraising journey for me or in the establishment of Innovate EDU where, you know, I have really struggled a lot. I'm a woman who's a technologist working in education, and there were doors that were shut in my face. There were challenges that I had to face, like as a female entrepreneur, as a CEO, as a female technologist, folks who didn't believe I knew what I was doing, folks who didn't believe I could build and engineer products, folks who, you know, there was a, you know, like there is still a ton of sexism in this space and particularly in technology. And, you know, I just want to make sure that we're aware that that really exists and we call it out and we advocate against it, because I think there are a number of female founders out there on both the nonprofit and for-profit side who experience a lot of challenges because of systemic gender bias in our space. And it is not something of the past. It is something that is still incredibly present, and it manifests itself in really interesting ways. You know, I have the ability to sit side by side with my husband sometimes and to watch us encounter a funder or a company. And the, you know, the funder will turn to me and say, well, how are your kids, Aaron? And they will never ask my husband, well, Claire and Robert are his kids too, right? And so it's important for us to also acknowledge that some of these things aren't just about great people or about winning, you know, winners win, that there's also real barriers that exist, not just for, you know, women out there, but also for people of color. And that's why I think it's so important to not consider your social capital finite, to really, you know, reach back, reach a hand out to say, like, can I give you advice? Can I help you find the way? Are there things that I can do for you? Is there social capital that I can help with? And how do we do that in a way that really invites folks to pursue the place where passion meets profession?
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that and everything so far in the interview. How can people get involved in Innovate EDU?
Yeah, well, Innovate EDU isn't like, you know, a traditional sort of volunteer organization. So we don't have volunteers, but we do have an Urban LabCorp fellowship in New York City, where if you're interested in becoming a teacher, you can do a year of service, lead small group tutoring and become a teacher. You can, you know, join. We're always looking for great, talented people to join our team. And then we lead some really great alliances out there that are trying to work at pretty specific problems in education. And so if you're a tech executive and you're building an ed tech product, come learn about Project Unicorn and learn about educating all learners. So you're building interoperability, accessibility, and usability into your tech products, making, you know, tech more accessible for young people all over the country. If you're somebody who's working with teachers and educators, come join us with Pathways Alliance, where we're really working at educator preparation pathways and trying to address some of those systemic barriers. If you're a school or district, come look at our product portfolio and see if there's a problem you have that maybe one of our products could address. And then we're leading a new big project called the National Partnership for Student Success with a group of organizations led by Everyone Graduate Center that is really calling on this country to mentor, tutor, come into their local schools and serve and meet this call for student supports. And so if you're someone who does have volunteer time in your local community, check out organizations like Mentor or others who are helping bring people, supports and people capacity to schools right now when our kids desperately need not just the instruction that they're getting and to make up for lost time there, but the type of mental health support, social supports, and emotional supports that come from great, awesome relationships with caring adults. So
awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you being on this episode of the Charity Church Show, Aaron.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Well, for everyone listening, again, this was Aaron Moat, the executive director of Innovate EDU on the Charity Charge Show. Check them out. Great organization. I encourage everyone to get involved. Thanks again, Aaron.
Thanks so much.